Simon. Coming up on today's show, part one of our event with Ken Rudin, with Rick Palacio and Steve House, the chair people of the Colorado Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, at Pepke Auditorium last month. Part one today, part two next week on Cross Currents.
That's such a respectful audience. They hush the minute you take the stage. They don't do that for me. Hi, everyone. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thank you so much for being here. We're so grateful that you're here, and we're so grateful to all our guests as well. Saturday night on his Twitter feed, Ken Rudin posted this. Ryan Lochte, revealed to be a liar and an embarrassment, has been hired by CNN as a political commentator. What's funnier than that post is the fact that the remarks that followed that were a lot of people thinking that it was the truth. It's one of the reasons why we're doing this tonight. Because in this season, I think it's not that much of a stretch that Ryan Lochte would be a political commentator, because news has become entertainment. It's a vicious sport right now. It's also, there's no civil discourse. There's no respect for each other's ideas. So we're happy to have this tonight as an example of really, really nice dialogue with differing opinions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ken Rudin. I'm going to remind you that we are recording this for later broadcast, so we will be turning over the mic to question and answer. When you do, raise your hand and we'll run a mic to you, so please don't shout out the questions until we get to the fun scuttle button at the end. I'd like to introduce Ken Rudin. He's one of America's foremost experts in politics and campaign history. He focuses on all aspects of politics, from presidential elections to the races for the House, Senate, and state governors. He's analyzed every congressional race in the nation since 1984. From 1983 through 91, Ken worked at ABC News, serving first as deputy political director and later as the off-air Capitol Hill reporter covering the House. Beginning in 91 and for most of the past 20 years, Ken was the eyes and ears of NPR's political coverage in his position as NPR's political editor and resident political junkie. From 2006 to 2013, Ken was regularly heard on Talk of the Nation in the weekly Political Junkie segment. Today, he hosts the weekly Ken Rudin's Political Junkie program, heard on Aspen Public Radio. He's also a columnist for the USA Today newspaper and website, and he has his own podcast, Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Please join me in welcoming our guest speaker, Ken Rudin. You're sitting on your mic. This is all staged. This is all part of the fun entertainment tonight.
Ken, you have 5 minutes. Wrap it up. What I love about politics, and what I love about I love the fact you're all here, and you're all here for public radio. And you know, I spent, as Caroline said, I spent 8 years at ABC News, and we covered politics differently at ABC News than we did at NPR and public radio. And I think the people at public radio are just so attuned and so smart and so curious. Whereas I remember this one story at ABC in 1988, and we're covering the 88 campaign, and we want to do a program, a show about the history of African Americans in politics. So I'm giving out assignments to interns. We're going to learn about Shirley Chisholm and the Black Panthers and Eldridge Cleaver and all that stuff. So I give out these assignments, and an intern comes over to me and said, "Well, I got everything you needed, but I couldn't find anything on Malcolm the 10th." And I'm thinking, no, that's not exactly right. And there was another time at the Democrat. This is the difference between TV and radio. In television, whenever there's an attack on a candidate by another candidate, immediately the cameras go on to get a reaction on the face of the candidate who's being attacked. So I'm at the Kennedy Center in Washington in 1987, and it's the first Democratic debate of the season. Michael Dukakis, Bruce Babbitt, Jesse Jackson, Paul Simon, Dick Gephardt, you know, all the Democrats are there. And so, of course, the cameramen are ready to get a reaction when somebody somebody's attacked. So Jesse Jackson is talking about the last days of Jesus Christ's life, which is, of course, is very important in the Iowa caucuses. And so he's talking about this, and he says, and then Jesus Christ went into the house of Simon the leper. The camera goes to Paul Simon for a reaction. Honest to God, true. So that is the difference, in my mind, between radio and television. Look, you know, we've seen nothing like this, and I think a lot of I'm so glad that we have the Democratic and the Republican state chairs here, because we were having a little chat prior to this event, and the pressure, you know, you think that politics, it should be, look, politics has never been easy, but there's a certain anger to what we've seen this year, that people who think that they're disenfranchised, that the system is rigged, that it's just not working, that it's being stolen from them. Donald Trump has already said that he feels that if he loses, it's rigged, and if he wins, well, it's rigged anyway, but I won. I did it. And the Bernie Sanders people felt that the deck was stacked against them from the beginning. And then the first day, or the day before the first day of the Democratic convention, we found those hacked DNC emails that show that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was clearly a Hillary Clinton person from the beginning. And, you know, a lot of criticism of Bernie Sanders and the campaign he was running. So there's a lot of anger and distrust on both sides. And we saw that at the conventions. You know, for all these years, we always say, oh, these conventions are so boring. I think the big story in the 2000 convention, if memory serves, was how long Al Gore kissed Tipper. I mean, that's how long, that was a big story in that one. Whereas now, this was really anger and emotion. So while I'm here to talk about the campaign, I dislike and I abhor and I recoil from all the viciousness that's out there. There is emotion, and we'll see if this election changes anything or not. There's a lot of comparisons to what we've seen with Donald Trump, and perhaps campaigns of the past, maybe Barry Goldwater, when a lot of the Republican Party was opposed to his candidacy. But I still remember, I don't remember the kind of anger and back and forth hatred that I'm seeing now between among candidates, among party officials. The fact that Hillary Clinton was booed at the Democratic convention, I was thinking of 1980 when Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter had this big battle, and it was ugly and it was personal, and it was, you know, a lot of things said at each other, but I don't remember anybody getting booed. But the fact is that when Ted Cruz stood up and, you know, gave his speech, the Trump people booed him. And when Trump people won the rules debates, the Cruz people booed him. And then whenever Hillary Clinton or Michelle Obama or anyone tried to talk about Hillary Clinton, the Bernie Sanders booed them. So it's just remarkable that for a country that has probably the most sophisticated and knowledgeable audience in its history, that we have such distrust, such anger, and we have such high unfavorables of these two candidates. So, you know, there's a lot of things what's going to happen. Right now there's a new LA Times poll that came out today that shows Donald Trump up by 2 points. Now, that poll is an outlier. Every other poll has Hillary Clinton up, but her numbers have decreased nationally. And, of course, the news has not been good for her in the past several days. The news, I mean, this is just, we talk about all the things that Donald Trump says and the insults on Mexicans and Muslims and the handicapped and women and fellow Republicans, and it's just mind-boggling to me. But at the same time, it's mind-boggling to me that the fact is Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee for president, and there are still foreign donations going to the Clinton Foundation. And the emails that were released this week shows that there was some kind of wink nod between Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and those at the Clinton Foundation. And so the fact that Bill Clinton said the other day that if she's elected president, we'll stop with the foreign and corporate donations, why not stop now? Why not have this? Why have this out there as something for Donald Trump to run on? And then the opposite. And then, of course, we always talk about the October surprise. The original October surprise, of course, was in 1968, where Lyndon Johnson stops the bombing a week before the bombing of Vietnam, a week before the Nixon-Humphrey race, and Humphrey almost won it. And of course, the Republicans always talked about an October surprise. But both parties are certainly capable of it. And we've seen with the hacking of the emails, For all we know, if there's somebody sitting with a whole bunch of Hillary Clinton emails or anything that was hacked from the DNC, it's very likely it could be released at the last second, which is scaring the Democrats to death. At the same time, I'm listening to the commentating about Donald Trump's presidential candidacy, and he gives a speech where he says, well, you know, I expect to do very well with African-Americans. I hope to reach out to African-Americans. And every commentator I've seen says, this is a new Donald Trump. He's mellow. And I'm saying, what? Wait, how? What? I mean, yet last week he hired Steve Bannon to run his campaign. Steve Bannon is the guy who wrote that, well, basically he compared Planned Parenthood to the Holocaust. He said that women who get harassed online should just get offline. The things he says, he hates Jeb Bush, he hates Paul Ryan, he's worked against both candidates. And so every time you think that Donald Trump is trying to make Republican establishment feel better, he says things like he'll make a hire like a Steve Bannon, or he'll say something. Today he went on a Twitter rampage against Morning Joe, and I have secrets about Morning Joe that I'm going to reveal. So, look, Donald Trump is convinced that he won the nomination because he did it his way. The campaign let Trump be Trump, and he didn't apologize. He doesn't know what that word means. He doesn't feel like he has to apologize. And why should he? Because he's the Republican nominee. He vanquished 16 or 17 other Republicans. If he's gotten this far so far, why not continue this way? But the American electorate, in my view, is completely different than it is in the Republican primary. Remember, after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, there was all these autopsies about, well, how could the Republican Party come back? We lost Latinos, we're losing Asian Americans, we're losing women. We have to learn from our mistakes. And yet, it seems like the Trump campaign is trying to double down on all that stuff and just say what we're doing is going to win. And he's pointing to these national polls that, while they didn't look good after the Democratic convention and Hillary Clinton got a big bounce out of it, they have narrowed in the past few days. Now, in fairness, if you look at every key battleground state poll in the country, everyone, without a doubt, without any exception, Hillary Clinton leads in every single one. But there are states like Ohio, like Florida, like Iowa. There are some states that have tightened up in the last few days. So I don't know what this means. You know, late August is not late October. You know, all the talks about Gary Johnson and Jill Stein getting 15 points in, you know, as a third-party candidate. We always say that in October, in August. We don't say that in October. But this is a very unpredictable year and a very angry electorate. And, so every time I think that Donald Trump crosses a line, Hillary Clinton will be completely unable to give a coherent answer about the emails or about the Clinton Foundation. And there are so many voters, and I speak to voters all the time, and I travel all the time, they say, either the only reason I'm voting for Trump is I'm afraid of Hillary Clinton and the Supreme Court. And Hillary voters say the only reason I'm voting for Hillary is because I'm afraid of Donald Trump and the Supreme Court. I've never seen more people set to vote against a candidate in this election than I ever have before. And there have been some bad elections in the past, but this is just remarkable. So anyway, I'm thrilled you're here. Obviously, the fact that you're here means you're energized and you care about what's going on. And I'm thrilled that I have these two, the Republican and Democratic state chairs of Colorado, which is such, I mean, if you look at the history of Colorado, you know it's a historic swing state. And here's a quick trivia question. Barack Obama won Colorado two times in a row, right? 2008 and 2012. Who knows the last time Colorado went Democratic two times in a row? Anybody know that offhand? With hands up? 1932 and 1936. It has not happened since then. So it's remarkable. I don't know if that means that Colorado is no longer a purple state. It's moving more blue, because in 2014 you saw the Cory Gardner victory, and that people started saying, well, maybe Colorado's not as blue as people think it is. But then you look at what's going on this year with the Senate race, with Michael Bennett, who I thought was his seat, and the open seat in Nevada where Harry Reid is leaving, I thought those were going to be very vulnerable Democratic seats. It's just not happening, or at least it's not happening in late August. We'll talk about the role of Trump and the rest of the ticket. We'll talk about Hillary Clinton and the rest of the ticket with my two guests, and I'm going to read their biographies because we only met for the first time. But it was a fascinating conversation because knowing that both state chairs need to unite their party if they're going to carry the state in November, as well as the Senate race and the House seat, the race and things like that. They have a tough battle ahead of them, and from what I got from this conversation, not everybody in their own party is thrilled with the role you have done. And I say that not mockingly, because I feel for them, because as a state party chair, you know there are amazing emotions between Trump and Cruz. You know that there are amazing emotions between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. I mean, it's so as a chair, as a state chair, you have to weigh all these things. You have to walk a tightrope to make sure that the party's united in November. And this year, it's not going to be that easy. So let me introduce to my far right. That sounds like a shot at Steve House, but it's not really Steve House. But Steve House is the chairman of the Colorado Republican Party. He was elected in March of 2015. He's an engineer, a service manager, a sales leader. He's been a Republican donor more than an activist, but he decided that he wants to take a more active role, and he was elected. He published a book in 2010, writing a healthcare book titled Beauty in the Business, right? I wrote a book on that. And basically, he's chair 2015. He has a tough battle to unite his party in time for 2016 and beyond. Rick Palacio is the chairman of the Democratic Party, born and raised in Pueblo. And as I say, in 1968, remember the Pueblo? Remember that? If you're old, that's a great joke, really is. He was assistant to the House Majority Leader Alice Madden. He worked as a regional director of the Colorado Democratic Party coordinate campaign. He worked in Washington for Steny Hoyer, right? Exactly. Another member of Congress,
John Salazar,
right? And he's been a chairman of the Colorado Democratic Party since 2011, the first Latino to hold the office. He's the only second Latino in the nation to head up a party. So thank you both for being here. And I think what I want to do is just, Steve House, let's start with you. I mean, obviously, if you think of the opposition to Donald Trump, at least at the convention time and leading up to the convention, Colorado was in the forefront of that opposition. As somebody who's trying to hold the party together, I mean, describe your role.
Well, it was a state that really favored Ted Cruz. I mean, our caucus and assembly process favored Ted Cruz, but a lot of the mountain states did, if you really look at it. It was Utah, Idaho, us, the Dakotas. I think there's a commonality between those states and, you know, what we believe in versus maybe an East Coast person who has a little different perspective on how we do things in Colorado. So I think that was part of what happened in the process. I've come to the conclusion that unity doesn't really matter in this election for the party. What matters in this election is there are a whole bunch of people who are really angry. And they're so angry, they aren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Right before the election, I got to do something to make them even angrier, right? So I don't need them to be unified with the rest of the group, which has a ideological conservative sort of perspective. But remember, I'm dealing with a candidate who you will never hear say conservative or liberal. He doesn't use those words. He speaks more about the nation and what the nation is. So I've got this other group of people who's trying to figure out, is he really a conservative? Is he really a conservative? And I think it's more about unifying them and then unifying the anger. And between the two of them, we win the election.
I could see the argument for Republicans saying that with the Supreme Court hanging in the balance and complaints about Hillary Clinton, it's time to vote for Donald Trump. But you also have a nominee who spent much of the time tearing apart his own party. Now, of course, that's what happens in a battle for the nomination, but it was in a lot of personal and somewhat sophomoric terms about the size of the hands and intellect and laziness. He called George W. Bush a liar. He's responsible for 9/11. When you want the Republicans to unite, or at least to vote against Hillary Clinton, what about the Jeb Bushes of the world and all those Republicans who refused to come to the convention because they were just so turned off by the Trump tactics?
I don't want to speak for Rick, but I think we had this conversation earlier a little bit, and that is that Bernie Sanders' people and Donald Trump's people have some similarities. They both call the rest of us establishment. And so there's an anti-establishment sort of perspective going on in this year's election. And I think the party itself is going to have to change. We knew it had to change before this happened. There's too many people falling away from political parties today and going to unaffiliated. It's a national problem. It's a state problem. Political parties have to figure out a way to add value to what they do in order for people to join those parties and become participants in it. But I think in the particular case that we're talking about, the people like Jeb Bush and George W. Bush and, you know, Lindsey Graham and others who will absolutely not support Donald Trump, you know, the question's going to be, if Donald Trump wins this election, what does the party do about some of its longtime stalwarts that no longer are in favor with the president? I think that's a party problem. I think we're going to have to evolve as a party to try to understand what is it that we want to accomplish. And Rick and I have talked before about the fact that there are certain issues in America today, like healthcare, like the economy, like some of the stuff that's going on in Colorado, that we must force ourselves to talk about these things in a nonpartisan way and actually solve some problems. Because right now, if you're using healthcare or if you're using jobs, especially some certain kinds of jobs and what's going on in the world, if you're using them against each other politically, everyone loses. And I think that's where a lot of the millennials are. I think that's where a lot of the anger is. We've got to figure out a way to evolve these political parties so that we literally start to get things done. Because frankly, in the U.S. government, I think the number is 74% of the time, neither party has the White House and both houses of Congress, which means you've got to be able to govern when you're the minority. And I think that's really going to be the key post-election. No matter who wins, we've got to figure out a way to solve our problems.
Rick, I saw at the Republican convention a lot of never Trump buttons, but I saw a lot of never Hillary buttons at the Democratic convention. And of course, as Colorado was a majority Bernie Sanders state, what message did you hear? I mean, and I remember when those boos were coming down from the stands at the convention, they did come from the Colorado delegate against any mention of Hillary Clinton as state chair. What do you do to unite the party? Is it just saying we can't have Donald Trump, or is it more than that?
Well, I think it's a combination of, I mean, Steve, unfortunately, is cursed with Donald Trump in 2016 and his party. So Donald Trump, I think, is going to be a huge motivator for a lot of folks just to come out to vote who may not otherwise have voted. But the other part of this, and we did have a majority of our caucus goers and then ultimately a majority of our convention goers that were Bernie Sanders supporters. There were a lot of young people, a lot of millennials. And what we've seen across Colorado and across the country is that millennials are particularly feeling left out of the process. They're feeling like they have they're burdened with student loans, they have no job, or they're being underpaid, and the establishment is not fighting for them. So they came out to support Bernie Sanders. But what's happening right now is they're moving towards the Hillary camp if they're not already moved, because they see that Hillary is that person. And Hillary, to her benefit, and I think to ultimately all of our benefit in November, has adopted a lot of the same principles that Bernie Sanders ran on. So when it comes to student loans, when it comes to jobs and the economy, especially things that are appealing to millennials, she's adopted them and is running on those issues. But I think they're going to come around, maybe not all of them, but the vast majority of Bernie supporters are already with Hillary. And I think that a combination of that and then a united front, and not just Democrats, but a lot of unaffiliated voters and Republicans that are going to come out just to vote against Donald Trump.
We could talk about all the so-called flip-flops that Donald Trump has had over the years over choice, trade, all those things. But the Bernie Sanders argument against Hillary Clinton is very similar about same-sex marriage. Not until she didn't come out in favor until 2013. She voted for the war in Iraq. Bernie Sanders was against it from the beginning. Trade deals, the pipeline, she almost came kicking and screaming to the progressive point of view. Is there something like, if you're watching Hillary Clinton campaign and you're watching her express these views, if you could give her advice, I mean, what would you say to her as a candidate?
First of all, you want me to answer that?
No, but I have a follow-up question to that, yeah.
First of all, I think I was not a Hillary supporter in 2008. I wasn't anti-Hillary. I just didn't know a whole lot about her. The first election that I ever voted in, I turned 18 the day that that President Clinton, Bill Clinton, was elected to his first term. Didn't know much about, or wasn't on board the Hillary bus in 2007, 2008, but had an opportunity to meet with her in a small group when I was working on the Hill in Washington. And that opportunity, really a 90-minute conversation with a small group, I was absolutely wowed by this person who, from that moment on, I could say, hands down, the most brilliant person that I have ever encountered. Just the depth of knowledge that she has on so many different topics. And the way that she was just personal, I think, connected with everyone in that room. My advice to her is just to make herself a little bit more vulnerable. Unfortunately, Hillary's been in a place where she has been attacked consistently by the far right for the last 30 years. And sometimes when that happens, it makes us put up barriers to the people around us.
Can I just interrupt for a second? But the FBI Director Comey is not among the far right who criticized her for her response to the email things. So it's not. I know the right wing conspiracy, the vast right wing conspiracy, is one reason why she's. But I think there's a pattern of just failing. Like, think of how Bill Clinton would answer something or Bernie Sanders would answer something. Hillary Clinton doesn't seem to have that. That gene in her.
Well, I think she doesn't necessarily have that gene in her. I mean, I think that she's partially there's some people that don't like the idea that a woman could be running for president, and part of that I think cannot be ignored. But she does not connect with people the way that Bill Clinton does. She's not the retail politician the way that Bernie Sanders is. But hands down, she is the most capable person that we have ever had running for president of the United States, and should be elected.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. If you missed the show or would like to hear it again, go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Have a great afternoon.